and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 326, interview with Robert Lofthouse about his upcoming book, Honor Through Sacrifice, the story of one of America's greatest military leaders, covering the career of Gordon Joseph Lippman. Lippman fought in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. The winner of 17 commendations, including the Distinguished Service Cross, the Silver Star, the Purple Heart, and the Presidential Unit Citation for extraordinary heroism in action against an armed enemy, Gordon Lippman is an example of living life to its fullest. As for the book, pre-sale details will be announced on the website www.holdtheline.press for a July-August timeframe. Also, check in on the site for additional stories about America's gallant men who won the freedoms we enjoy today. Mr. Lofthouse, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate you inviting me to be on your show.
Absolutely. So again, the book is called Honor Through Sacrifice, the story of one of America's greatest military leaders. Now, I have to ask, because I read this book like three times in prepping for this. So when I first read your book about Gordon Joseph Lippman, I was like, yeah, okay, Ray, you could be doing a lot better job living a fuller life, you know, really embracing your family and friends and skills and goals and desires, because that was the kind of guy Lippman was. He owned himself. He had his heart on his sleeve, and that really comes through in your book. So, and feel free to tell us about some of his awards, the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, so we get an idea of this man. But I have to ask, as you are related to Lippman, do you feel that push even more than I do to make as much of your life as you can? And while you're answering that, or while you're thinking about that, if you could give us an idea of how this book came about.
Sure. I met Gordon when I was 15. He's my first cousin. Mm-hmm. But that was the first opportunity I had to meet with him, because living in a small town in Southeast Kansas, we didn't get out much. We didn't travel, and he was on the road all the time, being in the Army, right?
Right.
So at the time that I met him, he was 42. I was 15. You know, our families had a great time together, and then he was shipped off to Vietnam shortly after that. So I knew him briefly, and I had heard family stories about him. Eventually, when I picked up my family genealogy and started doing that research, I wanted to write something about a family member, an ancestor that had done something great. And as I was looking through a number of options in my family tree, I kept coming back to Gordon Lippman.
Sure.
He's the most highly decorated member of my family. He did some wonderful things in combat situations. You know, when he joined the Army in 1943, he was 18, hadn't yet graduated from high school. In fact, I think he was I think he left high school when he was a junior.
Right.
He ended up a little more than a year after graduating from boot camp, leading grown men into combat at the age of 19. Mm-hmm. So the man had great fortitude. He had great courage. Everybody that I had spoken to and my family that knew him only had very complimentary things to say about him.
Right.
A leader of men, both in his private life and his military life.
Mm-hmm.
His family adored him. As I dug in more and learned more and more about him, I grew to appreciate him a lot more. I wish I had known him when I was younger and had been around him longer. I think I would have turned out to be a better person myself.
Right. Now, I have to ask, because I have five kids, four daughters, and, you know, you want to be a good role model for them. So I find this kind of thing fascinating. A lot of what is that saying? Leaders aren't born, they're made or whatever. But I just get the feeling this guy was born with his head squarely on his shoulders. But there were people in his life who helped him form to become the kind of man and leader that you're talking about. There's coaches, Boy Scouts, relatives in his family. I think he was even in the school play or something like that. Can you give us an idea maybe of some of his formative years and the people who might have helped make this young man into the absolute stellar leader that he was?
Sure. I would have to start with his mother. Middle of the 20th century, when women weren't so prominent in business, she was a leader herself. She started a local chapter of the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. She was a co-founder of a local chamber of commerce. She started her own grocery store and ran that for about 40 or 45 years, most of that on her own, as her husband had died. Mm-hmm. So I think he drew a lot of inspiration and a lot of his strength from his mother. Right. In school, he was athletic. He was involved in sports. He was actually a journalist of sorts. He was voted vice president of a regional high school journalistic society made up of about eight different high schools in Northwest South Dakota. Mm-hmm. I think he was a born leader. I think he developed his skills by being a member of Boy State. He was a Boy Scout. He was involved in the school theater and in the sports activities. He was also a member of the cheer team. Right. So he was a cheerleader. And I think those skills helped him in his adult life when he was going into combat, because he found himself in positions where not only did he have to lead his troops into battle, but in some cases he had to rally them to come back and fight the enemy. And he was involved in the Battle of the Bulge, as well as an action in North Korea, where his troops, his platoon was pushed back, and they had to rally back and defeat the enemy to move the line ahead. So he had a number of occasions where those skills came to the forefront, and he was able to display them. He was his battalion commander in the 517th Parachute Infantry Regiment was a man named Bill Boyle. They nicknamed him Wild Bill Boyle because he was a military man. He was a combat officer. He graduated from West Point in 1939, and he was very much involved in combat during World War II. And it was said about him that he would drop rank with anybody that challenged his authority. And I think some of that had to rub off on his men. And when Gordon was in Korea, I think he displayed that. He found himself in a situation where, his company was pinned down by enemy machine gunners while they were trying to take a position on a hill. And he ran out of ammunition. He ran out of his grenades. He ran out of his ammunition. And he started throwing his sea rations at the machine gunners to distract them so that his company could advance on the position. And they eventually overtook the enemy, and he was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross for that action. Wow. Overall.
That's incredible. Yeah, I remember that part of the book, the story. And I also remember that I was thinking it was a bit ironic in that this kid clearly was the total package. I mean, there's no telling what he could have achieved in life if there hadn't been World War II, if there hadn't been Korea, if there hadn't been Vietnam. But that's the way the larger universe works. So that's what he's going to go into. But I think you conveyed in the book that he did love being in the armed forces with a set of brothers, and they looked out for each other. So again, I think that was something that he was okay with. But sometimes you can't just help think, oh my goodness, this guy's got so much potential, but a bigger cause needs him. And I think he had no trouble with that. And again, like you said, he probably got so much from his mom. If there's something that needs to be doing, you just get up and do it and don't spend any time complaining about it. And that reminds me of his training. There were some of the funniest stories in there, besides the intense training that these guys had to go through. And I'll get you to tell us about some of that. But I absolutely loved it when some of the people who joined up with the parachutists were told by some doctor who should have his degree checked that, oh, you're afraid of heights? Well, maybe you should learn to jump out of planes. That'll help cure it. Oh, are you a criminal? Oh, well, maybe you should join the army. That'll wipe your record clean. I don't know if that really worked that way, but if they survived the war, that would help them a lot with their criminal record. So there's a lot going into this. There's a lot of people from different societies going into the 517th, not exactly cream of the crop. And of course, Gordon has got to work with them. But like you said, he does seem to be a natural leader, and he does seem to have this ability to size people up and to get maximum results from them.
Yeah, he definitely took the challenge and stepped up to it whenever he was faced with opportunity or the enemy trying to face him down. He was a full package. I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. But he's going into training at 18. And like you said, he has not finished high school. There's going to be people in there who come from the not wrong side of the tracks, but certainly tougher side of the tracks. But when you get into the army, I mean, and I'm trying to remember the name of the gentleman, I'm not sure if it was Wild Bill or someone else, but as they're going through training, their commander damn near wanted perfection. They wanted marksmen. They wanted these people to be able to jump out of planes, hand-to-hand combat. They wanted them to be able to think on their feet. So this training, and you describe it very well in your book, was very intense for these people, even for an 18-year-old who's probably already in very good shape.
Yep. I'll read a quote from another book that I used as one of my sources, a book called Battling Buzzards. Mm-hmm. It tells the odyssey of the 517th Regimental Combat Team between 43 and 45. And the quote that I pulled out of there said that the Army was convinced by 1943 that the assault upon Nazi-held Europe would yield swiftly to elite troops. So the Army created parachute regimental combat teams, drawing on volunteers willing to hurl themselves from airplanes and hit the ground fighting. So a lot of these guys who signed up became paratroopers because they got an extra $50 in combat pay by being paratroopers. And a lot of them were very athletic. A lot of them were rough guys, but there was a combination. They really did cover the spectrum from the guy from the wrong side of the tracks to good guys. And mm-hmm. Some of them were veterans. One of their lieutenants was a veteran of the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, they had a wide variety of guys that they took into these units. The regiment size itself was about 800 men, but they would interview up to 3,000 recruits that wanted to be in the 517th, and they'd pare it down to 800.
Wow.
So they really were very particular in who they selected to become a member of this team.
That wasn't just
the 517th. Yeah. That was for all of the parachute teams that the Army was training them. And you may recall the 506th Easy Company that was referred to as the Band of Brothers. Mm-hmm. They trained at Camp Tocoa a year before Gordon's unit trained there. So they got the same kind of training, same kind of guys. If you watch that Band of Brothers series, you'll see a lot of character development through not only their training, but as they went into combat and between their different combat situations. These guys, they trained together. They spent a year or more training together before they ever went to combat. So they went into combat as a team. They didn't go to combat. They weren't sent there as, one guy replacing somebody else. They went as a team, so they knew each other. They had worked with each other, lived with each other, drank with each other every day and night for a year. So they had a great affinity for each other and knew what they could expect, and knew who the strong guys were. They knew who the weak guys were, and they knew what they had to do to pull the companies or the platoons together to be able to accomplish their missions.
Yeah. So am I saying it right? They were at Camp Tocoa in Georgia. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but I would not want to run up that hill. And I imagine because you were talking about how many times a day they had to run or double time it or march everywhere. I mean, these guys were in top physical condition. Now, you can be in top physical condition. You can be mentally and emotionally tough, after that year of training. That's all well and good. But all of that was immediately put to the test, not fighting the Germans, but just trying to cross the Atlantic. They're on this big boat. You've got the U-boat menaces. You've got the boats going up and down on the waves. You could be tough, but I imagine this was quite a challenge for a lot of those young men.
Yeah. Being at sea and going across the North Atlantic, of course you had the North Atlantic storms to deal with. Yeah, most of these guys had never been on the ocean before. So I'm sure there was a little bit of seasickness occurring. And as they were getting closer to Europe, of course they started running into the U-boat wolf packs and the Luftwaffe that were trying to bomb the ships out of the water. Mm-hmm. It had to be a harrowing experience because on these troop ships, you would have thousands of troopers who couldn't really do anything because they're so packed in together.
Right.
When the U-boats attacked them or the German aircraft attacked them, what do? They throw on their life vest and they run up to the deck, getting ready to jump into the water. But then you have the aircraft coming down to shoot at them. So it's like, where do you go? Do you go up to the deck where you're going to dodge bullets, or you stay down below and wait for the torpedo to sink the boat?
Jeez.
So it had to be a scary place for most of those guys, not knowing where to go, where to be on the boat. And there is no safe place really, except when the boat lands in Europe.
Yeah. That's what I was about to say. There is no safe place. And I've got to think that for the vast majority of these boys, this is probably the first time they're outside of the United States. I mean, all this is new, and now you're on a giant boat and people are shooting at you. I mean, wow, that's a lot to take in.
Yeah. And so there are fireworks, right? If you're under attack at night, you got all the tracer rounds that are flying back and forth in the sky and all the noise and the commotion on the ship. So, you know, for a young guy, it's an exciting time, an exciting place to be, but scary at the same time.
So they're trained up, they're in top physical condition, they're a good team. And like you said, they know themselves and they know each other. And that's very important for any kind of sized unit. So it's May of 1944, the 517th, you know, they are on the ship, they get through, they go through the Mediterranean, and they finally reach Italy. And as you said, they are highly trained, but they're untested. This is going to be their first go around. So they're landed, they go in country, they're to the northwest of Rome, I believe. Can you give us an idea of what they were expected to do, considering this is their first real combat, and how did they do?
Sure. They were assigned to support what was referred to at the time as the Texas Army, which was another division that had already been in Italy and had been through combat, had been through Anzio. And the Battle of Anzio had just taken place and had finished. That was a 6-month battle to take Anzio. So the Allies were moving inland and pushing the Germans up north into the Alps, mm-hmm. and the 517th was assigned to go support that effort. So as they moved north, the army started fighting up into the hills and going into the Alps and the hills in northern Italy. It's not easy to get through there because you've got valleys and ravines and the hillside that you have to fight on, and you're fighting uphill for the most part. The artillery battalion was having their units leapfrog each other to try to keep pushing the front line forward. The 517th actually captured Montessario and Monte Peloso. Almost said Monte Pelosi. So they were in combat there for about two to four weeks, and then they were pulled out. They had accomplished their missions, mm-hmm. But they were pulled out because there was something big afoot. This was in June, late June, and as you know, D-Day occurred on June 6th. Mm-hmm. And the Allies were pushing the German army eastward into the center and east of France. There had been a battle plan to invade southern France that was put on hold because they thought that the Allies thought that they could accomplish a lot more psychologically and physically by going into Italy and pushing the Germans up into the Alps.
Yeah.
But this mission in southern France was brought back out of mothballs, so to speak, and they put it back together. It was almost as big as the D-Day invasion. Mm-hmm. Because they had the paratroopers that were engaged to land behind German lines in southern France, and then they had a large beach invasion that was scheduled to occur as well. So it was a replica of D-Day in the sense of the magnitude and the number of units that were involved, both U.S. troops, British, French, and other nations were involved in this. And so the 517th was, they were flown in early in the morning of I think it was August 15th. Mm-hmm. So it was a little over a month after D-Day. They were flown into southern France and dropped. And of course, you know, whenever they run a paratrooper jump, they send pathfinders out to light the way and give the pilots an idea of where their drop zones are. Mm-hmm. Well, in this particular case, just about everybody missed their drop zone. And so they had to, once they got on the ground, they had to scramble around and try to figure out where they were, how far they were off course, and what they had to do to get back to their rally points. So it was, you know, it was a lot of chaos. Of course, when you go into combat, you have a lot of chaos. Gordon was commended for his actions in southern France during Operation Dragoon. And some of his actions there actually led to a battlefield commission where at the age of 19, he was promoted to second lieutenant.
That's amazing.
So again, and you know, a 19-year-old second lieutenant never graduated from high school, leading grown men into combat. That just continues to amaze me.
Yeah. Now I remember this part of your book because when you were talking about when the 517th was first getting involved, and you're right. I mean, there's a lot of mountains and hills in Italy that's perfect for defense. So they're doing their part. They're helping push the Germans north. But right away, because of the nature of the style of fighting, they start taking casualties. But they do slug it out for a couple of weeks and they get put in reserve. And even though they missed D-Day, you're right, they're part of Operation Dragoon. And the casualties were pretty intense. I think I got from your book like 500 casualties, you know, wounded, and then another 102 men killed in action. So even though they're still young and this is kind of their second challenge, they did do their part. They did carry it out well, but they did pay the price for it. But I think that probably their officers knew this was going to be ugly for a while because the Germans, it's not exactly like anybody thinks of them as quitters. So even though you've landed in Normandy, you've landed in southern France, this is still going to be ugly for a long time. And they're just going to have to slug it out with these very tough professional soldiers, the German soldiers, who've already been fighting for years, but they're able to pull it off. And like you said, Gordon was given a battlefield commission. That's pretty amazing at the age of 19.
Very impressive. Yeah. So they had 2 weeks of combat in Italy and then a little over 2 months in southern France. Mm. And then they were pulled out, actually a little over 3 months in southern France. And then they were pulled out and given R&R, and they were sent to, I'm probably going to say this wrong, Soissons, France.
Okay. Which I always say it wrong, so it's okay.
So that is a town in farther up into the northern end of France that was behind the battle line. So that was in the rear, and that was an area that the Allies used to give their soldiers a break from battle. So they would rotate combat unit back to give them some R&R, allow the unit to re-equip and fix, you know, fix their weapons and fix their vehicles that were shot up and give them some training and, you know, a chance to take a hot shower and a chance to have some hot food, get a little bit of entertainment. Of course, the USO was prominent there. So the USO by, you know, in and of itself is a big story, the kind of support, and rest and relaxation that they gave to the troops was phenomenal. Gave them an opportunity to just refocus and get their heads out of combat for a while.
Right.
And then in December, all hell broke loose on the Eastern Front. The German army surprised General Eisenhower and his staff and came pounding through the Ardennes forest, and nobody expected it.
Right.
And that began the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, this part of your book, I truly appreciate it, and I enjoyed it very much. And I don't think I quite understood the kind of different points of view that Eisenhower and Montgomery, Monty, General Montgomery, had, because Eisenhower was like, we want a broad front. Let's just push along the entire line. Let's truly liberate France and not just a part of it. Whereas I think Monty wanted to like laser focus, gather some men and just push on into the Ruhr Valley where the Krupp arms manufacturer and other manufacturers were, because he knew it would hurt the war effort. But Eisenhower was like, no, we need to, you know, so they had to work that out. But in some ways it doesn't matter. Well, go ahead.
The Allied Supreme Command, when they planned D-Day, they also planned the after action. And the after action was going to be, if D-Day went well and they were able to push the Germans back, they were going to march them right into Germany. And as they got closer and closer to the French-German border, Montgomery was petitioning Eisenhower to take this action up north through Holland, that was ultimately called, Market Garden. Mm-hmm. And you're right. His goal, his objective was to push down from the north and devastate the German manufacturing, war manufacturing effort. And, so he convinced, and I'm sure there were a lot of there's a lot of politicking going on in the background, but he convinced Eisenhower to put the eastward push on hold, and divert resources to Montgomery. And so what ended up happening was the Allied front stopped along the German border, and it was like, I think it was something like a 900-mile front.
Wow.
And they basically camped out, and there were skirmishes here and there, but the Germans weren't really putting up anything more than probing efforts. And and the Americans were getting lackadaisical, thinking that they were they were okay to relax and take it easy, because nobody expected the German army to come through the Ardennes forest.
Right.
And even though the German army did that in 1940, and even though the German army did that in was it 1915, they had established their credentials and their battle plan strategy, and the German army, the Wehrmacht, was really pretty predictive, I think, because they had the same battle plan in pretty much throughout World War II.
Right.
And when they went into Prussia, they went into Russia, they went into France and Belgium and Holland. It was the same battle plan. It was a blitzkrieg, and they had the technology and the mechanized army that was unmatched in the rest of Europe. So they were able to quickly overcome and overwhelm their opponents, and that's how they gained so much ground so fast.
Mm. Yeah.
Winston Churchill said that before 1942, the German army never lost a battle. And after 1942, they never won a battle.
I remember.
And what happened in 1942? The Americans got in the boat.
Oh, yes. Churchill knew how to talk to his American cousins. He knew what he was doing. So We could easily sit here for hours and talk about the Battle of the Bulge, but of course, I think we should just narrow it to kind of Gordon and the 517th part of it. But again, you make the point in your book about the Americans pretty much just stop so Monty can do his thing, but that dovetails nicely with exactly what Hitler wants to do. He has this second big recruitment. He gathers up all these people from age, what was it, 16 to 60? I can't remember exactly. And he just comes...
Oh, yeah.
Barreling through, and of course the Americans and the British and the French and everybody else in Western Europe are totally not ready for this. So now it's the Allies who've got to scramble and try to stop the Germans from making it all the way either to the sea or to Antwerp. I'm trying to remember.
Well, I think Hitler had accepted the fact that he wasn't going to beat the Russians,
right?
And the only way to protect his flank on the left was to attack, to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think the German general staff really didn't want to do that.
Right.
But Hitler was Hitler and he ordered it.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so they had to fall in line and take their orders and do his bidding. So, when they busted through the Ardennes forest, mm-hmm. they did that at several points along the front. And what they were doing was really probing for an opening that where they could break through and divide the Allied line.
Right.
And to Eisenhower's credit and his general staff's credit, they were able to assess the situation and plug those gaps. Mm-hmm. And in one scenario that Gordon was involved in was in Hotton. Hotton is on the river with part of the village on the west side of the river, part of the village on the east side of the river. Right. And that was right outside of the Ardennes Forest. And there was an armored division, a small element of an armored division that was basically camping out in Hotton. So when the bulge started, they were under intense fire, mm-hmm. but the Germans hadn't come across the river yet. So Eisenhower sent troops in to plug that gap. And one of the units that was sent in was the 517th. So they were charged with making their way into Hotton and rescuing this armored division, and they did it, and they did it in a matter of days.
That's incredible.
The sad thing about the 517th and the sad thing about the whole Allied effort was that I think in the end there were some 84% casualties across the board. So that's wow. Pretty heavy. And yeah. You know, when you've gone through training with these guys and you're into the dead of winter, a year and a half with them, and losing them left and right, that's mm-hmm. that's got to be psychologically tough.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Gordon is now a staff sergeant, if I've got this right, leading a light machine gun platoon. And yeah, I mean, this is the time where leadership steps up, where he's got to say, yes, I miss all those guys too, and I'm devastated just like you are, but we have a job to do. And I think he did a very good job of being able to keep them focused and motivated, because that's what you have to do with troops, because the fighting is not over. It's far from over, and they've got to stay focused on the task.
Yeah, phenomenal. When you start looking at the numbers of mm-hmm. the aircraft and tanks that the Germans sent into this battle,
right?
And the Americans are just scrambling, trying to plug the holes and stop it. You know, Bastogne itself, I think, lasted, I don't know how long Bastogne lasted, but they were under intense fire for a long time. And these other battles were going on around Bastogne, and many of them you don't really hear about, but they're every bit as important and as intense as Bastogne was.
Right. Now, I find this interesting because we're talking about the Battle of the Bulge, and we're zoomed out. Obviously, that was many decades ago, almost like it was a chess match. But before the 517th and other units were sent in, they did get word that some German SS troops had massacred a large number of American prisoners from the 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion. So, yes, they're going in. Yes, they're scared because, oh, my God, you know, we got to stop the Germans. But at the same time, you get the sense that they wanted some payback, or they wanted some revenge, or at the very least, they were, I guess, hoping to make sure that that same fate did not happen to them.
Yeah, I think it's at Malmedy, Belgium, that Germans had executed a large number of American prisoners, or they were Allied prisoners. There were British in there as well.
Right.
That word got out. There were some survivors that escaped that, and the word got out, got back to the American troops, and in a way, it was a good thing because it convinced them that if they were thinking about surrendering to a German attacking them, that would convince them not to do it.
Good point.
Because they're, you know, better to have a rifle in your hand and get shot than not have one and get shot.
Right. So,
and that, you know, yeah. In the fog of war, you know, sometimes men get angry and their anger, you know, overtakes their senses. And so some of those atrocities happen on both sides, which is unfortunate.
Sure. Absolutely. So we've got this 19-year-old kid. He's good with the 517th. They fought in Italy. They fought in southern France. And now they're helping with the Battle of the Bulge. I think they were just north of Easy Company from the Band of Brothers. But if you can give us an idea maybe of what happens as far as at least Gordon goes with his combat experience, maybe into late 1944, early 1945, because we're getting close to the end here. At least as far as his World War II his career, but if you can give us an idea of some of his other experiences, that might help us begin to end this part of his story.
Sure. He was leading a light machine gun platoon, and they were on the attack. They were tasked with capturing commanding ground at Haidhitz. Capturing the high ground at Sur-les-Is, and clearing the woods on both sides of the road. They had to maintain a line of resistance between Soy and Hotten, which was the road between Soy and Hotten, and then break through to rescue the 3rd Armored Division that was garrisoned in Hotten and surrounded. And they accomplished all of those objectives. You know, it's amazing. These guys have been in combat off and on for 6 months.
Right.
And they performed admirably. They did what they were expected to do. They were able to cover their objectives. They never lost a battle. They lost a heck of a lot of men, but they won their objectives. For the most part.
That's incredible. Yeah, because you're right. I mean, someone sat down and said, we need highly trained troops because this is going to get ugly. And they do the job, but you're right. They suffered a lot. They lost a lot of friends along the way. Now, I want the listeners to know that we have only touched like 1/3 of the book, because Gordon will go on and he will fight in the Korean War. He will fight in Vietnam. So there's plenty that we have left out, but I really wanted to touch on his experiences in World War II. But Robert, if you can give us an idea of a little bit of what Gordon will be up to in the coming years, that might be a good place to stop. Because if I remember correctly, he did not finish high school. It's not like he's married. I mean, he kind of put his life on hold for the war, and then pretty soon his part in the war is going to be over. And I guess it's, to a degree, it's time to return to some kind of normalcy.
Yeah, he did get his high school diploma after the war. Right. He was a second lieutenant then, and he elected to stay in the Army and make it a career. And then during Korea, when he was called up after Korea had started, and he was thrown into the middle of a battle in Korea, where that's where he met his platoon.
Right.
He was assigned to be the platoon leader and had to go join them in the middle of a battle because they had lost their lieutenant. Right. So he picked up leadership of a unit that was a segregated black unit. It was actually one of the last remaining black companies in the Army at the time.
Right.
And had a storied history. They started out as Buffalo Soldiers in the 19th century and had a good track record during World War I and World War II. And now here they are in Korea, pushing up and down the peninsula, as that particular war seesawed back and forth. Mm-hmm. They would take a hill, secure it, and the North Koreans and Chinese would come right back and take it from them. And then the Americans would go take it back again. It was a seesaw event. But he had his combat chops from World War II. Mm-hmm. And he was able to apply that skill and that knowledge and expertise and lead these guys, accomplish great things in Korea. I don't know the numbers right off the top of my head, but a large number of members of the 24th Infantry Regiment, which he was a member of, had won Medals of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, Silver Stars, Bronze Stars.
Right.
I think 2,000 Purple Hearts. Just incredible courage in that regiment.
Right. That's incredible. Speaking of physical courage, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off if I did, but speaking of physical courage, I was near the end of the book, and this was burned into my memory. I will never forget it as long as I live. So I'm sitting there finishing up this book, this guy's incredible life. Yes, he was physically courageous. Yes, he was a great leader. He knew how to inspire his troops. He learned a long time ago, if you take care of your men, they will take care of you. But the part that really struck me, and I think he got this from his mother, you can tell me, was that just because I'm kind doesn't mean I'm weak. Kindness is not a weakness. Don't mess with me. And if you really do care about someone, you will tell them the honest, hard truth, no matter how much it hurts, because to do anything else is to be dishonest. And that's just not who he was. And so for all of the valor, for all the victories, for all of the courage, when I read that part of the book, I was like, this is the kind of guy I would want in my foxhole. And he just seemed like an absolutely just a stellar human being.
Yeah. Members of his family, of our family, have said that he was a saint. Every time they met him, he was courteous. He was a gentleman. Mm-hmm. He took care of everybody. There are family stories that I can't put in the book and I can't talk about here, but sure. As you said, he's the kind of guy that you would want in your foxhole. He's the kind of guy that you would want to be your best friend.
Yes.
He's incredibly gracious, humble, yet very strong and very determined in what he wanted to accomplish.
Yeah. I would just imagine if he was my friend or in my life, I would have been a much better person for it. Just because, I mean, how do you not see someone exuding that kind of confidence and leadership and not have it rub off? But again, we'll save that for the readers, because readers, believe me, we've barely touched this book. There was like at least 180 to 200 pages that we didn't talk about. And I just have to say this real quick. And he eventually gets married when he gets out of World War II. They can't have children, so they adopt three children. So what's not to love about this guy? But anyway, Mr. Lovehouse, thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for this book. And one more time, it is Honor Through Sacrifice, the story of one of America's greatest military leaders. Can you remind me of when this book is coming out, please?
Sure. It's due to be published October the 5th.
Okay. Do you know if you probably don't know, it's no big deal. Do you know if there's a window of pre-ordering for people, or do they pretty much need to wait until then?
Actually, we will be opening up a pre-order opportunity through Kickstarter in late August or early September.
Okay, good. So should people just search your name? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, you can go to my blog site and see details on that as we get closer to those dates. That address is www.holdtheline.press.
Okay, perfect. And so for those of you that buy it and read it, I'm just telling you now, when you get near the end of the book, maybe you want to be alone. You might tear up a little bit. I certainly did, but it was a heck of a roller coaster ride of a story. And again, I just thank you very much for your time and for being with us today.
Thank you, Ray. Many thanks. I enjoyed the conversation.